Matter of Cabral versus Commonwealth. Nice to see you, Mr. Collins.
See you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Rick Collins. I represent the.
Let me go ahead and ask you up front if you'd like to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Yes, I'm sorry. 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
As an initial matter, the Commonwealth raised the sufficiency of the record, and I'd like to start with that issue. I acknowledge that the transcript of the motion to set aside the verdict. Hearing would have been beneficial to the court. Frankly, it was a transcript I ordered. I did not insist on it being filed when I learned that it hadn't been filed based on the fact there had been a written motion, but certainly I should have given the court a better record by having a transcript of the hearing. However, it is our contention that there's a sufficient record.
There was no evidence adduced at the hearing. It was just argument on the motion.
As far as I know, I was not counsel at that point in the case, but I'm not aware of any evidence that was adduced. I'm certainly relying on the written motion and then the court's denial of that written motion for our argument on appeal. Our petition as well as our opening brief were based on the legal arguments advanced in the written motion, and so we do contend that is a sufficient record for this court to review it.
Counsel, that does bring up one question, though, in reference to the sufficiency. There is something made about the fact that there's not sufficient evidence to prove that this is a taser. And if there were parts in the motion to set aside or vacate hearing that address that, how would that impact your argument in terms of the transcript not being indispensable?
If there was evidence adduced to that, then that would be a problem. I'd have to concede that point.
Well, and you would concede in the trial transcript itself the victim referred to it as a taser.
I do, however, and I understand that the fact finder can draw rational conclusions, but during cross-examination, the victim acknowledged that she wasn't sure. She said, I didn't see it. I knew it wasn't a gun or a knife. I heard a sound. And I think that
coupled with the officer's testimony that when he found what he found, his testimony as to what it was, his testimony that it made, or at least he described, I think it could be fairly said, a similar sound, doesn't that establish at this stage reasonably that it was in fact a taser, and so your argument really is the legal one?
I was going to emphasize the legal argument because I do agree. Well, I do think it would require some speculation to say that because she heard a sound and the officer heard a sound sometime later that it had to be the same object, but I was intending to focus my argument on what I think is the stronger argument.
Where does that put us in reference to the factual determination? I'm just trying to parse it out.
Yes.
Because clearly there's an argument to be made that the transcript, in terms of whether it's indispensable, is not of any moment if we're just looking at the statutory interpretation.
Yes.
But if it is coupled with this argument that it is not a taser as part of the dangerous weapon part of the statute, if it's a two-part analysis, is this a taser and does it fit within the statute, what do we do with the first part of that? In terms of your argument, are you abandoning that argument, conceding that part of the argument, or indicating, as Judge Russell has said, that there's sufficient evidence in the transcript from the trial?
With respect to whether it was a taser.
Yes, that's the only thing I'm asking.
Okay. I'm not conceding that point. There's no indication that there is any evidence adduced at the motions hearing. I don't know. There are no exhibits in the record that were introduced there. The court could determine that there's insufficient record for whether it was a taser, but still have a sufficient record to determine the legal argument, which is to how to apply the statute if you assume that it was a taser that was used in this case.
Can we look at just the trial transcript and make a determination, as the court seemingly has, that it was a taser? Because there is a statement where the court indicates that the victim was tased 3 times. Would that be something the court could look at in reference to then analyzing the statute?
The court could certainly look at what the trial court's factual determinations were. I agree with that.
Okay.
As far as the sufficiency, the Commonwealth cites the Wolf opinion in its brief, and I would submit that the Wolf opinion actually supports the notion that there's a sufficient record in this case. Wolf actually had the subject of that was the trial, and the trial transcript was not introduced into the record in that case. Just like in this case, though, there was a written motion, there was an indictment, and there was an order denying that motion, and while the court had said in that case that was an exception to the general requirement for a trial transcript, it was a situation in which this court determined the record was sufficient. Based on the legal argument we're advancing, where we have a written motion that's consistent with that, we have an order denying that motion, I'd submit that this case is certainly well within the scope of Wolfe, and this court does have a sufficient record.
Assuming that it is a sufficient record, let's move squarely to the issue in terms of what you indicate we should read the statute as requiring a deadly weapon as opposed to a dangerous weapon. Given the fact that the General Assembly chooses its words carefully, how are we supposed to substitute in deadly for dangerous, and don't they mean different things?
Certainly the General Assembly is presumed to choose their words carefully, and I assume that they do choose their words carefully. But this court, as well as the Virginia Supreme Court, when they interpret the code, look at the code as a whole. And I cited two examples in my brief of other statutes in which guns, firearms, are implicitly stated as dangerous weapons when very clearly they meet any definition of a deadly weapon.
Well, right, but doesn't that go to all deadly weapons are dangerous weapons, but that doesn't mean that all dangerous weapons are deadly? I mean, especially given if we read the code as a whole, I assume you'll concede that the Attorney General has accurately cited a plethora of statutes that refer to a stun gun, a taser,
yes,
as a dangerous weapon.
Yes, they do. But the General Assembly is presumed to know case law. The Pritchard opinion, which is cited in my brief, indicates that a reviewing court has to look beyond what the intrinsic nature of the weapon is. So if we assume that this was a taser, I agree with the Commonwealth that fits the definition of a stun gun.
But for purposes of analyzing the statute, we have to make the assumption that it's a taser, don't we?
I mean, when we get to that
right.
point, yes, correct. But Pritchard says that you look beyond the intrinsic value, the intrinsic nature of the weapon, and look at how it was used. In this case, the victim testifies. There's no indication there's any support for this, but she says that the taser was not fully charged. There is no evidence concerning what a less than fully charged taser would do to somebody. I acknowledge the trial court, when it was going through its reasoning at the conclusion of the case, mentioned injuries to the abdomen consistent with tasing, but there was no evidence, expert or otherwise, about how a taser would cause any injuries to the abdomen. And more importantly, when the victim was reciting her injuries and she was given multiple opportunities to do that, she didn't list anything to the abdomen to the tasing.
Do you agree that taser and stun gun are at least, if not interchangeable because one's technically a brand, synonymous?
Yes.
Any weapon that is specifically designed to stun or incapacitate somebody for even a temporary period of time, isn't that definitionally dangerous? It's designed to make me lose my faculties and fall to the ground.
Correct.
That sounds dangerous to me.
It sounds dangerous to me too, Your Honor. However, in this case, the victim says that it wasn't fully charged. And just like a gun...
But it doesn't matter whether it's fully charged. Isn't it simply the design of the weapon and how it can be used? Because the statute indicates either use or threatening in terms of a dangerous weapon. So clearly, there's an indication it's not just how it's used.
In this context, though, there was no indication of a threat using the taser. The victim says that she was tased.
Right, but what I'm saying is if, in fact, there is the either-or, either the use or the threat, it doesn't seem like what actually occurs is what's important, but whether the weapon is actually something that could be defined as dangerous.
In light of the Pritchard opinion, I don't agree that that's the analysis that this court should employ, because Pritchard, again, goes into the manner in which the object was used. And while we're not talking about a threat here, so just like a firearm
I don't know. I mean, yes, threat can be I hold it out and show it to you. Once you've charged me with it once, twice, three times in this case, isn't there an implied threat that I might get stung again?
Certainly, but if that would be the case with the use of any type of object, once you've used it, there's a threat it could happen again, and so if that were the case, there'd be no reason to have the statute worded in the alternative use or threat to use.
Well, no, it would also cover a situation where it's never actually used, where it's just threatened, where I just point it at you, but then once I use it, it seems to me, and the facts in this case back it up, it would be rational to conclude that it was likely to be used again.
Even if I concede that reasoning, it still goes into what is the nature of the object. And just like a firearm that's not loaded, if I point it at somebody in that moment, by pointing it, it might feel threatening. It's not deadly because it's not usable in any sort of deadly way. A taser that is less than fully charged, there's no evidence that that would have the same impact as a taser or a stun weapon that was fully charged. That's what the evidence was. There's no evidence indicating what that would do.
If I threaten you with a firearm and you don't know whether it's loaded or not, have I threatened you with a dangerous weapon?
In a common sense way, yes. In light of Pritchard, no. That is our argument on that position. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Ms. Darin, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Leah Darin for the Commonwealth. I'd like to go to the adequacy of the record issue that we've raised on brief first. And I know that sometimes those arguments are perceived as picky, and the Court would like to reach the issue that's raised on appeal. But I think this case, at least for one of what I perceive as two sufficiency issues that are presented in this matter, should not be addressed by the Court. And so what we have here is a situation where the defendant on brief says he has preserved his sufficiency issue, whatever the issues are. He's preserved it in the motion to set aside the verdict. That's in his assignment of the error of the case at his brief on page 2. So what we have is the argument was raised for the first time in the motion to set aside the verdict. That is at pages 163 through 165 of the record. And we have no transcript of that hearing. We have the Court's order denying that motion, and I'm going to read from the Court's order, after hearing evidence and argument of counsel. So our position is that the lack of transcript in this case deprives this Court of the arguments that counsel actually made to the trial court at the motions hearing.
But we do have the argument that was made in the motion, and your opponent notes that you cite Wolf for one proposition, but it certainly seems that the bulk of Wolf, and finding that Wolf was the rare exception, it reads an awful lot like this.
Well, again, what we would say here is while those arguments could differ, but what also we're deprived of, and the Court's deprived of, is any what the position of the Commonwealth was on those arguments. And also, we're deprived of the trial court's assessment of...
But, Ms. Darin, do we have some indication from the trial that the weapon used was a stun gun and the Court found that so?
We do. So I think my position...
Let me ask the second part of that question.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. If that's the case, then, is that enough or sufficient for us to then do the de novo review of the statutory argument?
I believe it's enough for the Court to affirm the judgment. At the end of the road, it would be enough for the Court to affirm the judgment of the trial court, but inadequate for the Court to reverse. I think at the end of the day.
Because the Commonwealth may have put on evidence at the hearing, we just don't know.
And whatever the Court, again, we're deprived of the trial court's assessment. So I believe, my argument would be, number one, that you could affirm the judgment of the trial court, but you couldn't reverse, and that with the caveat being, unless as a matter of law, the court would say that this object, which was identified as a taser, which was identified as a stun weapon, was not a dangerous weapon. Unless the court could say, as a matter of law, this item was not that.
But you agree that the record, as we have it, is sufficient to address whether a stun weapon, assuming that is what this is either within the statute or outside the statute?
If that's his only argument, if it is an issue of law, I believe the court can address that. But I think if you look at pages 163 through 165 of his motion, it's not limited to that. He has not said as a matter of law that...
So is your position that because he's not conceded that it is sufficient to find it a stun gun that we're not able to actually to the statutory...
Again, I believe that the court could look at this record and say, on this record, this is a stun. This was the court, the trial court could infer that this weapon, could infer from the evidence that this item that he produced was a taser, was a stun gun, and it was a dangerous weapon. All right. So we look at the statute, and I'll move on to the sufficiency issues. Under 18.267.3, aggravated sexual battery requires, as applied to the facts of this case, that there was a sexual abuse. Well, we've got that. The victim says that the defendant grabbed her. She's out jogging. He grabs her, takes her to the ground, and in the course of asking her for money, and when she doesn't have any, he gropes her. He puts his hand on her vagina. And that was against her will. And the statute goes on to say by force, threat, or intimidation, and that the defendant used or threatened to use a dangerous weapon. We perceive that there are two sufficiency claims here. Number one is the sufficiency of the evidence to show that the item used, presented by the defendant, was a taser or a stun gun. Also a stun gun, otherwise known as a stun gun, and whether the evidence was insufficient to show that this taser was a deadly weapon. So that second part of this argument is the statutory interpretation argument, and we would submit that based on the identification of an 18.2308.1 of a stun weapon, being a device which emits a pulse of electricity designed to incapacitate a person, and that stun weapons are used or identified as listed among dangerous weapons in various parts of the code, and we've laid all that out in our brief, that it was reasonable to infer in this case that this item was a dangerous weapon. The court did not have to make that additional leap of whether this was a deadly weapon, which other counsel has argued. So we submit that the evidence was sufficient to show that this item was a dangerous weapon. It's been identified as such by statute. The court, the General Assembly, used the term dangerous, not deadly, in the statute, and so we must presume that this choice was intentional. So on that part of this case, certainly the Commonwealth met its burden. With regard to the facts of the case, the victim is out jogging and she's pulled down. She says, first of all, she says that he has an object in his hand. She says, well, it wasn't a gun or a knife. She said it was a taser. That's at page 15 of the record. She said she knew it was a taser because it emitted a sparking noise. That's at page 15 of the record. And he used it on her three times. She said she felt the shock of it. That's on page 15 of the record as well. We have in very brief, there's other evidence that this man presented as a security officer or a police officer and said something about that's the kind of line of work he was in. He was going to teach her a lesson that she needed to be more careful. And they locate him and his truck very close in time and in proximity to the where this event occurred. And in that truck is a stun weapon. The officer specifically says it's a stun weapon at page 60 of the record. So the court was entitled to infer from that evidence, as it did, that this was the that the evidence was sufficient to show that there was a taser, a stun weapon used on the victim, And we would submit that even if there had simply been an offer of this weapon, of this item, that the victim believed was a taser, stun weapon, that that would have been adequate to for the court to find the evidence sufficient to support the use or threat to use of a dangerous weapon. If the court has no questions, we would ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Darren. Mr. Collins.
I don't have any rebuttal, but I'm happy to answer any questions that counsel's argument presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. We'll come down and greet counsel.